Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Kevin Krause. Joining me on the show this week is breaking news reporter Nahid Rajwani.
Hey there.
And soon to be covering Dallas City Hall, Tristan Hallman.
Hey there. How's it going?
Back again. We'll talk today about an anti-Islam shooter who went missing after he was released from police custody and the police officer who recounted his experiences the night the two men attacked a cartoon contest in Garland. Mike Hashimoto will also end the show with some thoughts on that. And later on the show, we'll be talking again with reporter Dave Tarrant about the reaction to the article he and Naomi wrote, intertwining the stories of a suspected killer and his victim about the deadly shooting New Year's Eve in Denton. Let's get started. Nahid, I understand there was an anti-Islam shooting on Christmas Eve that you wrote about. Tell us about that.
Sure. So this shooting happened the afternoon of Christmas Eve at Omar's Wheels and Tires in Pleasant Grove. This is a shop that's owned by Muslims. It's surrounded by a lot of different shops that have a lot of very American names. And this one specifically has the name Omar in it. And authorities say that Anthony Torres, who's a 31-year-old, went to the shop a few weeks before the shooting on Christmas Eve, asking whether or not the owner was Muslim. And after learning that the owner was Muslim, Torres reportedly remarked, "All these Muslims, they've been making problems for us." And he threatened to come back and kill all of the workers at the tire shop. Now, it's important to note that this tire shop is owned by Muslims, but the majority of the workers there are Christian. Some of them are Middle Eastern. Some of them are Latino. So it's not like there are a lot of Muslims working here. The afternoon of Christmas Eve, however, police say Torres drove back to the shop and asked where the heir was. And he was also reportedly asking customers at the shop if they had seen any Muslims or if they were Muslim. And allegedly, he walked back to his car, got a gun, and started shooting toward the tire shop. And it was a shooting spree that the owner of the shop himself, whose name is Omar, ended. And the shooting resulted in the death of a non-Muslim man who had come to the shop to fix his tire, and another Christian employee who is actually of Kurdish descent was injured, and he still remains at home. He hasn't returned to work yet because he was shot in the chest. There are two other people who were grazed by bullets, neither of whom are Muslim, and officials at the Council on American-Islamic Relations have said that they are concerned that the alleged shooter, Anthony Torres, could come out of jail and injure the people at the shop and kind of finish the job, essentially. In the end of January, Anthony Torres, the suspect, had posted bond on charges of murder and two charges of aggravated assault. Last week, however, he was arrested again in Rockwall. And authorities there say that he walked into Trend Tower, which is an office building there, and knocked over some vases and said he was tired of, quote, the rich oppressing the poor. And he was arrested after police say he lied about his name. But for some reason, he was released from the Rockwall County Jail while authorities in Rockwall were waiting on some documents or something from Dallas County to basically say that he couldn't be released. So for something happened there and he ended up getting released and he went missing for a while. And again, Muslim leaders and especially the people at the shop were concerned about Anthony Torres kind of being out on the run, essentially, and possibly coming back to harm them. And on Wednesday, he was arrested by Dallas authorities, and now he's in the Dallas County Jail.
So most of the time when these kinds of things happen, if you're out on bond and you're arrested again, they do put a hold for insufficient bond on your jail record. So what happens in most of these cases is Rockwall arrests you, then Dallas County says, hey, we actually have this guy out on bond for a murder charge. When you're done with him, send him to us. Do you have any idea why that didn't happen in this case?
It's hard to say what exactly happened. We asked officials in Dallas County and Rockwall what had happened, and it seems as though it's possible maybe there's some miscommunication or something happened to where they knew that this suspect wasn't supposed to be released from Rockwall and had to have a hold, but maybe that didn't get processed or go through in time for him to actually be kept in the jail.
Wow. So a paperwork snafu could possibly result in this guy reoffending?
It's possible. I mean, he is back in the jail. So, and it's possible that his bail now will either be increased or he won't be able to leave despite posting bond. So it's possible they'll try to keep him in there for as long as they can until to make sure that he doesn't get in trouble again.
Oh, right, because the county will revoke his bond on the murder charge,
yes.
Right? And so he'll be remanded back to custody. Okay.
So normally when you get bond, or at least with some people, you have conditions that say you cannot leave this county because bond is not meant to be a punishment. It's meant to say you need to show up to court because of the nature of this charge. You're this much of a flight risk. You will pay this amount of money because we want you to show up to court for your appearances. And a lot of people interpret bond as like, you know, well, because we don't want you out of jail. It's more because jail is you're innocent until proven guilty. In this case, that didn't seem to be something that the county was keeping track of, was it?
Yeah, it seems it's strange because it seems like he was released January 13th. He was out of custody then. But of course, like you mentioned, Tristan, there are bond conditions that you have to follow. And a lot of times you're not allowed to leave the county, but he was arrested in a completely different county. So it's possible that maybe that constituted as a violation of his bond conditions. And now that he is back in Dallas County, that could be used against him when they try to determine whether or not to keep the same amount of bail or increase that for him.
Yeah, it sounds like he violated several terms. Number one, he reoffended. And number two, he left the county.
He allegedly reoffended again, not convicted, but
right,
he was
accused
of a crime.
Well, but that's enough to revoke your bond.
Right.
You don't need you just need probable cause for that, so... he should be not getting out anytime soon.
How is the Muslim community reacting to this?
They are pretty upset, and I think they're concerned more so because they believe that it was an act of domestic terrorism, and they feel like it didn't get as much attention or as much serious attention as something in a different situation would be. Like, for example, one of the owner of Omar's Wheels and Tires, who's the one who reportedly shot the suspect and ended the spree, he said, you know, if this was a Muslim guy who'd shot up a white or a non-Muslim tire shop, he believes that it could have been different, and or that, you know, maybe the case wouldn't get as bungled right from the get-go. So he doesn't really have much faith, I guess, in the justice system, given what has happened so far and the way people react to certain other incidents where the alleged offender is a Muslim.
Okay, interesting. Thanks, Nahid. We'll look forward to reading your story.
Well, on a slightly different note, yesterday in Phoenix in federal court, we found out the name of the Garland officer who stopped two gunmen who were, I guess, at least inspired by ISIS to carry out an attack on the Curtis Colwell Center last year. That officer is Gregory Stevens. We had gone months and months and months without knowing who he was. All we had heard was that he was kind of this, he was a good cop. He acted, above and beyond that day. There was another cop with him who ended up getting shot in the ankle. But basically, he took out the two, I guess we can call them terrorists, who were trying to shoot up the Draw the Prophet contest with his service weapon. While they had machine guns, they were armored. They pulled up quick and without warning. One of the things that he described in court was he said that they had he will never forget I think this may have been the other officer, but the smile on the gunman's face when this happened just before the shooting started. We're learning more about the officer, a little bit more here and there, but, he had been kind of this mystery figure. He'd been nominated for Texan of the Year, and I'm sure Mike Hashimoto will talk a little bit about that later, but we now finally know who he is, and we're not sure, what that means for him, but he's certainly becoming, I guess, a celebrity after the fact.
Yeah, I wonder if he's going to do some TV appearances or some talk shows. Who knows?
Well, the whole reason that they withheld the name in the first place was they said there were security concerns. You don't want to say, hey, this is the guy who stopped that ISIS attack. I mean, I don't think we necessarily know who was, chasing the San Bernardino suspects. But
well, some of those Navy SEALs who took out Bin Laden. They wrote books and they did interviews.
One of them under a pseudonym at first. They also know his name. Chris Kyle, obviously, everyone knew who he was and he did get killed, but it didn't have anything to do with that. So it should be interesting as time goes on to find out more about this officer. I could see that just by Googling his name yesterday before the torrent of news came out, which will probably bury his name underneath the search, that he's been nominated for these community awards before. So it's pretty incredible. You never want to have the cop with your name in the news because it's usually bad. In this case, months after the fact, we find out who he is, and it's actually good.
Yeah, I mean, he really he saved the lives of a lot of people through quick reactions and obviously good training.
Definitely. There were about 200 people, I believe, in that at the time. A few reporters, I believe our reporter had just left because it was wrapping up that day. So pretty incredible stuff. I remember the Texas Municipal Police Association president saying, this was superhuman. This kind of stuff doesn't happen.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot, Tristan. Appreciate it. So now we're going to talk about The First 48, the TV show that everyone knows about and loves. Apparently there was a lawsuit, Tristan, involved in this show. Tell us more about that, please.
All right. Earlier this week, I guess it was Tuesday, the attorney, Don Tittle, who's kind of a high-profile person here, he's sued the city a bunch of times, usually over police stuff. He has taken up the case of a man who was featured on The First 48 as an informant. They blurred out his face. They blurred out, I believe, his body. Giant blur. But you could pretty much, people were able to figure out who it was pretty quickly. Now, this lawsuit alleges that because of The First 48 and because this guy never consented to being on the show and people recognized him, that he has been the subject of retaliation. In August, he was shot 4 times. He says that the guy who shot him, Michael Kenneth Scott, has been charged. He identified him as the shooter. He said at the nightclub the night before, he ran into him and he called him a snitch. Now, there's a little bit of history here because another guy, a guy who was initially charged, and you can actually see it in that episode, Clint Stoker, for killing this Jamaican drug dealer in the Redbird area, who had a pretty low profile but also had $900,000 in cash in his house, in safes, and just boatloads of marijuana, and ledgers that showed $28 million of transactions over the years, that he pointed to Clint Stoker and this other guy named Dion Bell, whose nickname was 21. And Dion Bell was basically the Omar of Dallas. If you've watched The Wire, he robbed drug dealers. He was kind of notorious. He ran a crew of people. He was a suspect in other murders, but nothing had ever been linked to him directly. So he had faced charges. He was actually facing other charges at the time that he was killed later. But anyway, Clint Stoker. So Clint Stoker called him. He was one of the people that was allegedly in 21's crew. He called his mother after the show aired and said that he was, something was going to happen to his son because of this. So pretty easily pegged him as the guy. And, from the context of the conversation, the guy said that he got the information from Clint Stoker. So process of elimination says you're the guy. So this lawsuit is seeking over $1 million because he was shot, because he's had to fear for his life, and because they say it's against the production company, not actually A&E, because they say that the production company didn't do enough to prevent this.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit about the show for those of us who aren't familiar.
Sure. The show is about homicide investigations, and from about 2006 to 2013, they shot episodes in Dallas. Sometimes that would be an entire episode. It was like documentary style. They'd follow a homicide detective as they went through the first 48 hours, although that kind of stretched out over the years. It's important to get leads in the first 48 hours it's important to solve the case in the first 48 hours. So they would have entire episodes. Other times they would do episodes where it was Dallas and, say, Memphis and New Orleans, and they would do, three different police agencies, and you'd have homicides. This one was a full episode devoted to just this. And actually, I talked to Michael Kenneth Scott, the shooter in this case, in a jailhouse interview back in August when it happened. He claimed he had actually never seen the show.
Why would I retaliate for something that I don't even know about? I was incarcerated when all that heard and all that, so I ain't even know nothing about none of that.
You were where?
I was incarcerated. I was in the penitentiary when all this happened. So all this, I'm trying to retaliate, and I got something against him. No, it ain't that.
So he wasn't in the penitentiary when that happened. I looked up the record, but he claims that he didn't shoot him. He had nothing to do with it. He didn't have no interest in retaliating against him. Regardless, before he went into surgery, he said this was the guy. You know, the first 48 is actually, I found, especially in covering crime stories, that witnesses will come up on the scene and you'll see a homicide detective and everyone will say, oh, I've seen that guy in the first 48. People watch this show, and I've heard that criminals watch this show, that they've busted houses before where they have the first 48 on TV. So people know this stuff. I mean, especially, you know, in some neighborhoods, you know the suspect, you know the victim. You're going to watch the show. So, you know, the believability thing part, you know, I don't know whether you can believe him or not, whether he saw it, but this is what the shooter has alleged.
Well, is there any legal precedent here? I mean, as far as you know, has this show been sued before, or maybe a similar reality show?
Yeah, the show has been sued before. I don't really know the outcome of those cases, but I know that this isn't the first time. It's the first time I've really heard of a retaliation like this where someone actually got shot four times. I mean, he's lucky to have survived that.
Yeah, when that happens, you wonder, like, what is the liability of the show? Like, what could they have done more to protect people? I mean, with the advent of all these reality shows now, you know, you'd think their lawyers would, you know, maybe be able to anticipate these kinds of problems.
Right, and you have to also, I mean, he says that he sought police protection, and actually two of the cases, two people were brought up on retaliation charges other than the guy who was the shooter, the alleged shooter in this case. But so there's only so much police can do. You can't really hire private security. The production company right now is the only one being sued, although A&E may be added later. Don't expect the city of Dallas to be added because the city didn't get, you know, compensated for this. This was just an agreement. It does raise a lot of interesting questions. You know, had he just testified at a trial, would he have also been identified as a, you know, snitch in this case?
Right. And you know, people are killed, shot at, who have testified. Witnesses are intimidated, you know, who are disclosed in court records. So, I mean, you can't really completely keep this out of the public eye.
It'll definitely be an interesting legal case going forward, but probably will take some time.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Tristan. Now joining us in the studio is Dave Tarrant. Welcome, Dave.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
You and Naomi Martin wrote about the fatal shooting of Sarah Muchlechner, a UNT student on New Year's Eve. In the story, you said her suspected killer, Eric Jamal Johnson, and she could have been friends. The story joins together their lives. I hear you've received a lot of feedback, positive and negative. What have you heard?
Well, Kevin, we've gotten a lot of feedback. The story got a lot of views online, and of course it was in the print edition on Sunday. What we heard from people was that they felt the people who were opposed to the idea of having one story that explained the lives of the two people involved in that homicide, they felt that they should have been separate stories. Several people used the word equivalency, that somehow we were finding an equivalency between Sarah, who was the young woman who was killed and who was a designated driver that night on New Year's Eve, and Eric Johnson, the suspect, who is accused of shooting her. For people who don't remember, they basically had seen each other at a party, a college party on New Year's Eve that was off campus. Eric, who was in the Marines, was here on leave. He was there with some of his friends, including two people who performed hip-hop that night. And basically, they rolled up at the intersection at the same time as there were some words between the cars. It got nasty, and as Sarah pulled ahead of Eric's car, he's accused of shooting at the car, and the bullet hit her. What we did was look at the path that these two people took to that intersection, the path that their lives took. And some people felt from the get-go that we shouldn't have done that basically we were creating this equivalency between the two that wasn't there. What we did find, and even her friends pointed out, that they seemed to have a lot of common interests and might have been friends had they known each other.
What was some other feedback you received?
Well, the feedback generally was that he was a monster and we shouldn't even try to humanize him. You know, my feeling about that is that we do that a lot. I mean, whenever there's a big story, whether it's, you know, from the Kennedy assassination on down, there's a lot of interest in who is this person who is accused of this heinous crime. And the other, and Naomi and I talked a lot about this, we also felt like there could perhaps be, somebody might see this story and think of a situation in which they might be involved in, and maybe this might prevent something like that in the future. Certainly, Eric Johnson, who wrote to us after Naomi interviewed him, basically had a life prior to this shooting that seemed to be going in a pretty good direction. He had been in the Marines. He was really interested in the creative arts. He was obviously trying to get a hip-hop career off the ground, rapping under the name Santana Sage. He was he had actually sewed his own clothes, was into fashion design, and according to his friends, was a pretty good guy, you know. And But the fact that we were saying that and humanizing him in such a way really offended a lot of people.
Yeah, and I think we should be doing more more of that in our crime coverage. What I liked about the story, it was more nuanced. You know, you could tell he wasn't a bad guy. I mean, he did a terrible thing, allegedly, but he was a human being, and, you know, we tend to demonize people, like you say, but it's not always, you know, as black and white.
I think it's one of those issues that people wrestle with all the time, and as to whether, evil is something that you're just going to be, or whether it is something that you act on in a moment.
Dave, how did the families involved in this react to the story? What was their reaction?
Well, we were never able to talk to Eric Johnson's family, the suspect's family. His mother, we called her several times. I left notes at her door, he does have several siblings, but we weren't able to get in touch with them either. So we basically talked to a lot of his friends. I went down with a photographer to Martindale, which is near San Marcos, to talk to her parents. And they were very open with me down there. And after the interview, I told them that we were looking at possibly doing this story where we would show their lives as they headed toward that intersection. And they seemed to understand. After the story, I got a text from the father who said that the story had upset him and his wife. He didn't go into more detail on that, but he did say, I do think the stories probably should have been separate.
What went into the decision initially to make them the same story rather than two different stories?
We talked a little bit about doing two separate stories, but I don't think it really went anywhere. I think we really saw this as a way to show, especially as our reporting took us more into each life, I think we began to see some common ground. And moreover, we also began to see the fact that both were the same age and had similar dreams. They both wanted to go into creative fields. And so one of the things that led us to doing it that way was to show that these people were on the same path until they got to that intersection. Now, you could argue that Eric was dabbling in some areas that may have put him in a place that was dark. He was really interested in guns. He was into the gun imagery. Some of his page in which he talked a lot about his persona Santana Sage and the music he was creating would have him posing with guns, including a AK-47. So he was doing things that were much darker than his life as a Marine.
Even if you had separated the stories and had them two separate stories, you know, you would still be humanizing him to some extent. Do you think the reaction would have been as fierce to them being separate to the story if it were just his own story?
I think we still would have gotten, as you pointed out, some reaction that we were trying to humanize him. I even heard that we were trying to turn him into a victim. I'm not sure how we did that. But I do think that it might have tempered some of the criticism. I mean, to me, you're not making an equivalency between two people just because they're in the same story. I mean, I've said this to somebody. I'm not sure it's the best example, but you can find Jesus and Judas in the same chapter of the Bible, and that doesn't make them equivalent characters. This story is what led them to that intersection where their lives collided, and we felt that it was the most effective and efficient use of space to put them in the same story.
One of the things that I was particularly interested in was the Santana Sage dichotomy with Eric Johnson. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, those sort of dueling personalities and how you just decided to give this much weight to this much weight to that? You know, looking at those two different things while you're also looking at the two paths that kind of diverge into almost three.
Yes. He had created a persona, which was his rap persona. He was rapping under the name Santana Sage. And the lyrics of the songs were pretty dark. I mean, there was a lot of profanity, of course, but that's not unusual in urban music. But also, a view of the world that was much darker, more violent. And I think you could argue that artists do that an artist will engage in imagination and putting himself in a place, especially if you've created a separate persona. I mean, fiction novelists do this all the time when they create a character. The question for us, and it's really difficult to answer, is to what extent was he engaging actively in that persona outside of music? And we don't know what happened that night exactly. We have a police affidavit that talked about there was a verbal exchange, there was solicitation, there was this sort of vulgar solicitation from the guys in Eric's car toward the girls in Sarah's car. We don't know what was said back, and not that that would excuse anything, but I'm just saying we don't know the whole verbal exchange. But we do know that for whatever reason, Eric felt comfortable enough to pull a gun out. And so somewhere in his mind, he felt it was A, okay to bring a gun to a party or with him that night, and B, to brandish it. And so you've gone that far down the trail, and you may or may not have taken something that night. And again, we don't know anything about whether he did drink or take drugs or whatever. And I'm not saying he did, but once you've started down that path, then the third step, which is actually firing the gun, may not be that difficult.
Well, thanks again, Dave. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I want to once again thank Dave Tarrant and my co-hosts Tristan Holloman and Naheed Rajwani. Join us again next week. Our show comes out every Thursday. We are on iTunes, so be sure to subscribe to our channel. Tweet us at Texas Crime Cast, and remember to find more on all of our stories today and continuing coverage on DallasNews.com. Our producer today is Tommy Noel. I'm Kevin Krause. Now here is Hashing It Out with Mike Hashimoto. Take it away, Mike.
The news business moves fast, although seldom at the perfect speed. Stories come, stories go. So it's good to pause and remember a day last May when the story didn't happen, at least not as the criminals intended. That was when a lone Garland police officer faced down two heavily armed terror suspects and shot them dead. Just like that. Body armor didn't save Elton Simpson or Nadir Sufi. They intended to crash a Muhammad cartoon contest in Garland. Gregory Stevens said no. We knew the story, but now we know the officer's name. He testified Tuesday in Phoenix in the federal trial of a third man accused of aiding Simpson and Sufi, Abdul Malik Abdul Karim. He's believed to be the first person tried in the U.S. on charges related to the Islamic State terrorists. Stevens told jurors exactly what you might have expected. When Simpson and Sufi started firing, quote, "my training kicked in and I did what I was trained to do," end quote. Or in another era, one riot, one ranger. Garland police wanted to protect his identity in December when our newspaper named him a Texan of the Year finalist. It's nice that we can finally put a name with the heroism.